Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brown, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our journalist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Oh, Margaret, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing all right. It's summertime. Things are nice.
Yeah.
And academic DJ, Oliver Wang.
Happy June to you, Guy.
Happy June to you. It's Pride Month, Oliver. What are you proud of?
You, Guy.
Good. And winter's on assignment, so we have special guest Anne Friedman, journalist and one half of the beloved podcast Call Your Girlfriend.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. And what should we know about you?
I mean, I think you really hit the highlights. I don't know. I write a column for New York Magazine and I do this podcast. Those are the big ones.
That's exciting. It's good to have members of the New York media elite here. I mean, Margaret's fancy in media and all of that, but it's provincial West Coast media. Most of her work is done on red carpets.
She's still in the West Coast, though.
You know I live here, right?
I mean, but still, you work for one of the, your boss is like on Sixth Avenue, though, right?
I enjoy being everywhere and nowhere. Like, my phone's area code is San Francisco. I live in Los Angeles. I write for New York. It's like, you don't know where I am.
So we're maintaining a working Bay Area majority on the show?
I mean, if you're going by phone number.
Oliver, you have a San Francisco phone number, right?
I have a East Bay.
Ooh,
510.
What is your iTunes 3-line abstract of Call Your Girlfriend? The description for
it. Oh, God. I don't even know.
I mean, just tell us. What is the podcast?
I'm sorry. Now I'm concerned. I know what you're asking me. It is a long-distance conversation between me and my friend Amina, who does actually live in the Bay Area right this second. Uh-huh. And we talk about politics and pop culture and heavy stuff and light stuff and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Kardashians. You know, the whole thing. The whole bit.
Some of my favorite things.
The whole gamut.
So coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about politics and TV and film. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I've been reading a really beautiful, though depressing, novel by Adam Hazlett called Imagine Me Gone. I don't know if people are familiar with Adam Hazlett, but he wrote a novel a few years ago called Union Atlantic that did a brilliant job of exploring the financial crisis, but from a very personal point of view. Basically, this family, you see them go bankrupt, you see them bankrupting other people, it's complicated. But in Imagine Me Gone, it's following a family that's tormented by mental illness that basically is passed down from the father to the son. And it's just beautifully written. Hazlett writes these incredibly precise descriptions of emotional internal states of mind that I really think he's like pretty unrivaled right now for doing that. And it is depressing, but it's one of those things where the work is so beautiful that it elevates beyond what the subject matter is, and you don't feel depressed reading it, oddly enough. So I don't know. I think he's masterful. I think he's one of these writers that he can craft a sentence so precise that something magical happens.
That's lovely. And speaking of summer reads, let's remind everybody that Pop Rocket Summer Book Club is happening.
It's happening. Today is the official start date. We're reading Sylvain Neuvel's Sleeping Giants.
Which I finished the other day.
Wow.
It's a quick overachiever.
Read.
I mean, I did it in two evenings and it breezes by.
Yeah.
I have thoughts of it, but of course I'm going to save those for a month. But I enjoyed it mostly.
And speaking of mental illness issues, Anne Friedman, what are you all about this week?
I'm always all about Maria Bamford, but she has a new series on Netflix called Lady Dynamite that I am reveling in.
Yeah.
It is just so weird and in the best possible way. It has a little bit of that like meta, I'm a comedian Hollywood stuff, which I could really leave. But most of it is a delightful romp through mental illness and her own insecurities and psychoses. And I don't know, there's something about her where it's like she's a Midwest gal like I am, and there's also that straightforwardness about, I mean, I think everybody knows that, like, you know, comedians all have a dark side.
Yeah.
but there is, I don't know, and maybe it's refreshing to me because she's a woman doing it and it's not sort of the Louis C.K. like thing. I don't know. Well, whatever it is, I love it.
Maria's is so present and it's so sunny when it's delivered to you. Just these, you know, she can in her lilting little tone give you the harshest facts of the meltdown she had in Chicago. And, you know, looking for a phone booth and you know, then having to be 5150'd. It's so harsh. But the thing is it's – she always gets back to, it's just my life in the way that, like, your life is your life. It is managing a disease. But it is a really fun show. I also get really annoyed with like things being too Hollywood about Hollywood, but I feel like they have turned her manager, who is also to some extent my manager, into like a really funny, ridiculous, like comedy character who is kind of distanced from like sticking it to how the entertainment industry works.
Totally. And I think it's more, I say that more about the, there's some jokes in the early episodes, like, really, you're going to do stand up in front of a brick wall?
Yeah.
Or like, I mean, there's something where not being a comedian and not being a super deep comedy fan or stand up fan, where I'm like, I recognize this is a joke that's not for me. Or like, I recognize this is an insider joke. And that's fine. There's not so much of it that it wrecks it for me, but I'm just a little bit like, side eye.
I really feel like after you get out of the pilot, you start getting into the fun. Like,
yeah.
The second episode with the bisexual former addict was such a, like, it was comedy on just like the most open level of, oh, I'm dating this guy who has sex with guys. That is weird. But then to just sort of the idea of, we have all had a journey to get to 45 or whatever, and, you know, we're all going to be damaged goods to some extent.
Or that episode is actually about things that we say we're cool with that we're unwilling to acknowledge that we're not that cool with.
Yeah.
And not in a way that is sort of, I don't know, like grossly prejudiced or bigoted, but in that sort of like, we're uncomfortable because it's different kind of way.
She's a beautiful creature.
I've only seen the pilot, so I'm reserving any extensive judgment beyond that. I thought it was interesting and quirky. I don't know if I was completely on board with it, but I should probably give it more shots or more episodes. I find what I did like about it, or at least what I found interesting, is simply that it's at least part of it is set in Highland Park. And I haven't watched Marin's show, so I had no idea that, you know, it's been like four seasons and it's also set in Highland Park. But we've seen sort of Silver Lake and Los Feliz and some other prestige, you know, network sitcoms. But this was the first time I had seen something set, at least, again, partially in Highland Park. I mean, Café de Leche's in that pilot and the crazy gentrified playground across the streets in it. And it does feel like there's been a shift in sitcoms and dramas set in Los Angeles, which have moved away from sort of the mid-city, Sunset Boulevard or West Side, Palm Tree area, and has now come closer to the East Side, which at the very least is someone who's interested in the geography of the cultural geography of LA, I find intriguing.
I miss like TV writers pretending like they knew how Cleveland worked. Like we've just, there was like refreshing honesty to this is just about our world, but it's now like after Love and Transparent, which just feel like so fixed in these like, you know, one very east, one very west, but sort of like very LA situations. I just sort of want some America that feels real.
Some hello, Cleveland.
Some hello, Cleveland.
You might have to actually hire writers from Cleveland, though. I mean, do people really want to do that?
Only if the writers from Cleveland went to Harvard. The head writer of...
There you go. They've been filtered through.
The head writer of the show that I work for is from Cleveland and went to Harvard.
They still shoot in South Pass, though, because that can just pass for Cleveland.
Sure.
How long does it take until you understand the language of the show? Because I felt like watching the pilot that it was almost in a different language. And I am a huge fan. I love her, but it took me a while. It's so jarring, the kind of you know, fourth wall breaking that she's doing and the certain jokes that maybe I'm not getting because I'm not a comedian. I don't know, but like, yeah.
I feel like there are three big voices happening. Maria definitely, but also Mitch Hurwitz and Pam Brady from South Park. And I feel like the first episode is really trying to show you, look what we're doing with this, like we're breaking this genre. And I feel like after that you get more comfortably into understanding the Duluth flashbacks and understanding, though, like, they do make a way more complex timeline than they need to for a sitcom.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like Mrs. Toad's Wild Ride. I'm just like, I just want to be in Maria's world. And, like, the stuff about, you know, totally agree. I'm like, I don't really care that it's set in Los Angeles. In some ways, I wish they had just set it in Duluth and left it there. I just want more of her. And there was something so nice about being like, oh, you got a bigger platform and a budget for your voice. I'm not watching you on YouTube that I really like.
But you did you watch the,
yes,
the YouTube series?
Devotedly.
The YouTube series is so great because Maria's doing her mom and Maria's like doing everybody.
Yeah.
And so you just see it through her. It's wonderful. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So I feel like this is a bit of a broken record because I mentioned this. I've been all about them at least twice before in the last, I don't know, 6 months, which are the Golden State Warriors. who will begin, they are revisiting the finals starting, depending on when this airs, well, Thursday of this week, and just came back after being down 3-1 to a fantastic Oklahoma City Thunder team. They probably shouldn't have made it all the way back given the circumstances, but they managed to do it, especially behind like astonishing God mode play by Klay Thompson in game six. And for a team that's been incredibly fun and just mind-blowing to watch all season long, for them to continue this run into the postseason, well, I mean, people expect them to do well, but not necessarily in the way that they've done it, just takes what was already sort of an insanely unbelievable story and has now elevated to some next level. So still about the Warriors.
I like your consistency.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Thank you.
This week, I'm all about the Whit Stillman adaptation of Jane Austen's adolescent novel, Lady Susan. It's called Love and Friendship, and it's real good. Whit Stillman made three phenomenal movies in the 90s and then went away. He goes away for a long time between movies. He made Damsels in Distress a couple of years ago, which wasn't as great. You also saw it, Margaret, right?
Yeah, it's very awkward and stilted. And it's not Stillman, but stilted.
And it's this guy who loves to write about adolescence and class. He loves to write about just how dumb, smart adolescence can be. And it's really, really charming. But he basically, you know, wrote about kids from the Upper East Side enough. And then where should he next turn? And the answer was, you know, Regency Britain. It's really, really great because it's Jane Austen before she learned to want a little bit of romance, to want a happy ending, to sort of like believe in the possibility of relationships working. And I feel like there is something deeply in the soul of intelligent 14-year-old girls of being obsessed with wicked ladies. Because Whit Stillman is somebody who always needs this sort of like outsized, saying too much character who's just got too much charisma for the game around him. And I love it. And, like, Lady Susan, who is this wicked woman who, like, seduces men and bends them to her will and is constantly toying with people like puppets. And it's a grand old time.
I think he brilliantly taps into, in general in his movies, the fact that when you're 14, you are, like, more of an adult in certain ways than you are now as an adult. Because you are completely posturing and you're convinced of your intelligence.
Yeah.
And that all you have to do is just quote, like, the cool book or you know, the brilliant text of some kind. And, yeah, I think that's hilarious that he knows that so internally about children.
Wait. Anne and Margaret, when you guys were, like, teenage, especially younger teenage girls, were you preoccupied with, like, wicked women? Were you preoccupied with, like...
Still am.
Yes. because Lady Susan really is just, like, she gets what she wants. She does what she wants. And,
oh, yeah.
And like, her ability to manipulate the stupidity of people around her is amazing.
I mean, that's what, like, soap operas run on.
Yes.
Is that kind of character.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically a soap opera character surrounded by human beings who are just trying to figure out how to, like, put the brakes on her. And it's delightful. And Chloe Sevigny is in the movie for no real reason. all right, you're listening to Pop Record. We'll be right back to talk about politics and TV and film after this.
Hey, I'm Barbara Gray.
I'm Brandy Posey.
And I'm Tess Barker.
Together, we make up the Max Fun podcast, Lady to Lady.
Each week, we welcome a kick-ass lady guest.
We talk about our lives, our dreams, and the terrible decisions we've made that still haunt us.
Mm-hmm. We've had on great comedians like Aisha Tyler and Margaret Cho, plus screenwriters, doctors, authors, you know, anyone who's willing to be as open as we are.
It's all a lot of fun. That's us, Lady to Lady.
Can you keep a secret? Neither.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Anne Friedman.
Margaret Wappler.
And Oliver Wang.
And Oliver, this week you wanted to talk about politics in TV and film. It's an interesting year where TV and film have decided to go be in politics.
Yeah. And I think originally we'd been batting this around and to time it around the new season of Veep, which started about 4 weeks ago. But I think really the larger backdrop to this is simply that I feel like the real life political campaigns that we're seeing because of both the GOP and Democratic side are now have exceeded sort of whatever kind of fantasy world that could be created in pop culture. At least maybe that's part of what I think we're here to discuss. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about is it wasn't that long ago where it seemed that Hollywood was ahead of the curve in terms of, all right, they had female presidents before we still don't have a female president. They cast black presidents before we actually had Obama. But now
still
we're
still never seen a gay president in an action movie.
Maybe that's you should tell, like, I don't know, the Ehrlich, who am I thinking of? Roland Emmerich, right? Who you would think, actually.
Who you
maybe.
Would think, yes. Yeah.
He's probably working on it right now.
Right. That would be Independence Day 4 or something. But I think what we've seen, especially with this past year with, you know, with the Donald, is that the surrealism of American politics now seems to make something like House of Cards seem almost quaint by comparison. And so that was sort of the genesis behind this idea, is to talk about this line between how politics is represented in our pop culture world, but also how is it manifesting right here and now. And I think in a lot of ways reshaping what we think of mass media and how politics gets covered in the narratives that rise out of it.
Well, there's something so interesting about the fact that, yes, Donald Trump is a figure from pop culture who has decided to invade politics. But also, like, Hillary Clinton, just by her presence on the scene for the past 20 years, has managed to be interpreted by pop culture so much already. She hasn't even gotten the nomination, but Emma Thompson's already played her. To an extent, Tia Leoni and Sigourney Weaver have already sort of like interpreted our consumption of her. And it's interesting too, at that point in time, like, it gives you a huge amount of power. It really is the reason that nobody ran against her on the Democratic side and everybody got bowled over by Trump on the Republican side. But it also brings with it this horrible amount of baggage that our imagination has already gotten to play with this person.
Well, and also she has consumed, like, shows and movies and whatever that portray her as well. You know, there's the cover of New York Magazine this week is a great profile of her. In which she says, yeah, like, you know, Bill and I just sit, kick back and watch The Good Wife or Veep, you know? And it's like The Good Wife is, you know, at least the initial premise of that show is like essentially Bill and Hillary.
Yeah.
It's so weird to think about that.
Like, well, particularly the cheating aspect.
No,
Bill
exactly.
And Hillary.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
There was a British series from like 20 years ago called like The Politician's Wife or something like that. And it was really great, but it ended with this, like, wronged wife rising from the ashes and running for office, which then felt like this very Shakespearean dramatic gesture, but is just now the world.
Yeah, which is exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, if I were I like that narrative better than, you know, evil, sort of fascistic, like, power-hungry capitalist, like
demagogue.
Demagogue like grabs power. I mean, you know, there's it is an interesting question, because if you ask people who are like diehard campaign types and speech writing types, they'll just be like, it's all narratives and it's all storytelling, and you know, those are kind of the two stories. And you're right, like, we've seen versions of both of, well, the presumptive nominees in both parties.
If I can just go off of what you just said a moment ago, Guy, which is that, you know, the fact that Hillary has remained in some fashion or other represented, whether directly or indirectly through these various characters that you're naming a moment ago, for the last 20 plus years, I feel like in general that rarely is an asset to an actual political candidate, because usually, I don't know, for one thing, it's interesting to me that Hillary still has sort of this charisma gap in terms of her dislikability. Ratings are quite high, though not quite as high as Donald's. But despite the fact that she's ever present, that doesn't seem to have translated into sort of political capital for her. And you think about Sarah Palin sort of getting ethered by her depictions. I mean, she does a good job herself, but it doesn't help when you have Tina Fey like taking that like to an even further caricaturish level. Does it ever benefit a candidate?
I mean, it is what gave Hillary the traction to be able to show up in both 2008 and 2016 and say, I have all the money from the establishment. I have all of the official support from the establishment. And Obama was able to push through that, but it still is just, it helps to make her a behemoth. One thing I think is interesting is that I'm obsessed with our attempts to fictionalize Bill Clinton while he was still in office to just after. I like a nice Air Force One. I like a nice The American President. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to rope Bullworth in there.
Yes.
But all of those hinge on removing Hillary. All of those are about what if our president could date? Like, what if our president did not have, this creature by his side who was... We knew both the best parts of him and sort of like the least fun parts about him, which is why I love Emma Thompson as Susan Stanton in Primary Colors. I really feel like that is the one representation of Hillary that lets her cry, that lets her understand how hurt she is by like him fucking around and that being a personal betrayal as a wife and also... We spent 20 years working to get to this spot, and you're going to go fuck some – it's an educator lady in there in Primary Colors. But, like, the scene where she throws her keys at him was apparently, like, directly taken from events on a campaign bus.
There's something about the 90s and the Clintons in particular that lent itself well to a lot of satirical political movies. I mean, I feel like there was a dead spot for a long time in the aughts with maybe only Oliver Stone's W being in there as like a real thorn thrown or real spear thrown at Bush. But, you know, there's something about the Clintons that creative people felt like they could make fun of them, they could lambaste them, but suddenly, like, we were kind of dead for Bush. I mean, except for, you know, like, Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live. I mean, there were people doing it on, like, TV level. But I don't know. The movies, I don't remember as many incisive critiques.
Well, and he does also show up. James Adomian's George W. Bush impression shows up in Harold and Kumar Go to Guantanamo Bay. But it was, I mean, that is reflective of the fact that what Bush was involved in was not a comfortable joke because it involved so many wars and so much of a crisis of national security. But Oliver Stone's W is such an interesting piece of culture because it is halfway in between real legitimate criticism and a sketch. Like, it is so weirdly campy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think rightfully so, because you cannot address what's going on in that White House without having some sense of the ridiculousness of it.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely has – it really does this tricky balance of making you feel sorry for W at certain moments, but then also making you just, like, rage at certain aspects of his hypocrisy. I mean, Josh Brolin and who plays Laura Bush again? Elizabeth?
It's Elizabeth Banks, yeah.
Yeah, Elizabeth Banks. I mean,
that was that year that Elizabeth Banks was in everything.
Yes, and then kept being in everything, like, for every other year. But there's something about the two of them – I mean, they both of them were, like, brilliant at portraying Laura and George Bush. Like, I don't know. I just rewatched it like a year ago.
Anna, are you a Veep watcher?
No. So I worked in D.C. at a policy and politics magazine for 4 years, and my stomach for watching political television is not strong.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I've had many, many people tell me I should give it, like, a real shot. And I've seen the thick of it, you know, which is the...
British,
you know, yeah,
series
sort of a, yeah. a British analog, you know, but I don't really know enough about British politics to, like, go deep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the short answer is no.
I'm curious, though. So why was your experience having worked in D.C., working on politics and policy, why did that turn you off from sort of political, the fictionalized political theater of it?
Well, okay, so think about it this way. What is a thing that you are not really that interested in, even if, though you understand it's really important? Like, I don't know, like finance or something?
Okay, sure.
I'm guessing.
All right.
Sure, whatever. Example.
Okay.
You know, and let's say you happen to get an entry-level job where that's, like, all you focused on for years, and you had to go really deep on it, even though maybe personally it was not your number one passion.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I feel like I had a long, I'm still in my long detox period. It's also really, like, I being close to the machinations of, like, how politics actually happens is not only, like, boring, it's sort of like, I don't know. I did watch, like, season one of the Netflix House of Cards and I think half of season two. But I really enjoyed it just because I was like, oh, you're forthrightly evil. Thank you.
Okay. Here's an issue.
Yeah.
Back in the 2000s, we had The West Wing, our liberal blowjob of a fantasy of what if our president were a liberal with convictions? And we got that the whole time that we had George W. Bush. Now, it's the Obama administration, and we have House of Cards, I will argue Game of Thrones. We have all of these How the Sausage Gets Made TV shows. And was that counter-programming against Obama? And why is it at a point in time that we love watching House of Cards, we cannot look at Hillary Clinton and respect her as Francis Urquhart or Frank Underwood that she is?
So you're arguing that the popularity of House of Cards, how should that translate in terms of for Hillary?
The thing is like House of Cards is so much about process and about getting doing the stuff you need to get stuff done.
Oh, okay.
That like we should have, I think, a more comfortable relationship with the fact that like if you want to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs. I mean, it does show Frank Underwood as an evil creature. I mean,
and the show's called House of Cards,
but
which
he's
just
not making an omelet. He's just like doing a bald power grab.
Right.
And I think that, you know, like one of the things that I actually liked about or found satisfying, at least about the first season that I actually watched, is that there's no illusion of we're trying to change things for the better or we're trying to enact policy that like fits our worldview. It was just like, we want power. This is a game. And like there was an aspect of living in DC where it did feel like that, where it was like, you know, people would say lots of things about why we should pass XYZ bill or go to this or hold this summit or whatever. But it was like, it was all just like hand jobs.
Yeah.
I think part of what the point you're making,
so
too,
much can boil down to hand jobs.
I think we've entered into a cycle of very deeply cynical political fiction. And
yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily a reaction to the Obama administration. I kind of just think it goes back and forth, because you could probably go back to the 1970s and see the same thing coming out of Nixon, obviously, and the Ford administration, too. I just think that we cycle between our idealized American politics and then the deeply cynical. And right now we're enjoying the deeply cynical phase of it. And maybe it'll brush back to the other side at some point.
But we've also got Veep. We've also got this very interesting representation of a female vice president, then president, that really is a celebration of how powerless she is. And it's very lovely and charming. How does it reflect back on our approach to Hillary?
I mean, the presidency is kind of powerless. Like, I mean, this is one of the DC truths, is like, especially if you've got both houses of Congress against you as a president, there's definitely stuff that you can do. I'm not saying people shouldn't care about who's president. You should definitely care. But, you know, we put a disproportionate amount of attention on who we're electing president. Meanwhile, like at all of these, state and district level races, things are going to hell.
Right.
And, you know, and that is where, you know, they're I wouldn't even say two sides of the same coin. That's the wrong metaphor. But they're definitely related phenomena to how much you can get done. And no wonder nothing happens with the presidency.
These narratives kind of let us divorce ourselves from our own culpability for not showing up for off-year elections and, you know, letting these things happen. Like, when participation drops to, like, 30-20%, you're gonna keep getting the candidates who old white people like elected to office.
I think Veep does a good job, though, of showing how Selena is just a cog in the machine who gets brought into these scandals that are like haphazard and completely, you know, foolish and crazy how it happened. You know, like I was watching a recent episode where she accidentally tweets something about China, something incendiary, and it just sets off this chain of events, which I think is part of the kind of political scandal machine. Like,
yeah.
It often, I mean, this whole, the reports that have just come out about Hillary's email. A lot of people are saying, like, it isn't that bad what she did. It's all about her cover-up kind of attempts that make it seem more guilty. And I think those kind of layers are what Veep plays into really well.
And getting so into a mindset of trying to cover your ass that you don't think about, like, the long term of it. Like, she ends up basically having to start a, like, cyber war with China because she's trying to cover up that tweet.
That tweet,
right.
Yeah.
Who saw this week's episode?
No, not this. I saw Lost.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's called C-Word Gate. And it is a really, really great episode. But there is a moment when Selena is talking to Anna Chlumsky, her former chief of staff. I don't know what her title is now. But who's been tasked to figure out who called the president the C-word. And she figures out that it was everybody. But, spoiler, but she just says... it's because people hate women. Like, and she just goes into a thing of, there's this moment where you have these two women who have been able to achieve great things, but also at great cost, and sort of wondering, was this worth it? Why did I do this? And the lingering specter of that word and the dehumanization of women who strive for power. Like, I do think that we dedicated a lot of psychological energy to what will a black president be. And most of it was just sort of like nice Morgan Freeman's to calm us down. And I feel like it is a different kind of psychological task to be like, you know, what if the man is a mom and a grandma?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting, you know, hearing that plot point, you know, what I know of Veep and kind of the bumbling nature of her character is like, I as a non-watcher had always thought of it as like, is this how you're diffusing a woman's grab for power? Like, if she's just kind of like, you know, not super competent and caught up in scandal after scandal and not like, you know, sort of the anti-Hillary, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, who is, you know, to a fault about plans and like policies over being charismatic or whatever. What is that? I don't know. Maybe it's meant to be an antidote to sort of the Tracy Flick.
Yeah.
Yeah, although it's interesting because Selena on the show is competent and not competent,
yeah,
often in like the very same moment. And I think that's another like Hillary, that's reflective of Hillary as well, because there's something about her being like, well, why can't I use my email on my BlackBerry that's so like incompetent, yet we understand it.
The code switching that takes place on Veep, where they go from a room where they are not allowed to say certain things to a room where they are just trying to get things done, is wonderful, because it really does illustrate the way that like all American politics is taking place in this weird language of inoffense and never saying anything and realizing there are those conversations behind doors.
Well, it reminds me of what people are calling like the dog whistle kind of mentality with Trump, that, you know, the Republican Party has been making the same claims, you know, the same racist ideology. I mean, this has been going on for a long time now. It's just that the whistle's louder.
Yeah.
I was going to say, in terms of something Anne was mentioning a moment ago about sort of the banality of how Washington and politics works. And I think with House of Cards, it wants to make a big to-do about something that ultimately at its heart is kind of banal. And the thing that I think makes Veep really work well is that it embraces and makes the banality like the center of the comedic tension anyways. It's like, at no point does anyone, you ever feel like this show is about important things happening. It's just hyper important to them. But we all, as the audience, recognize it as being inherently banal. Yeah.
I would say it inculcates a different kind of love for Selena than we are used to having for women on a TV show. And that's kind of important for Hillary, because the old adage is Republicans fall in line, Democrats fall in love. And you've got this person who's so in the public consciousness that you can't, like, none of our traditional ways of falling in love with a woman work for her, because she can't be Tip O'Neill or like old Ted Kennedy, who's like, that guy, he sure does drink a lot of liquor and kill some ladies periodically, but God damn it, he gets shit done, you know? And we like can't love a lady that way. All right, I'm going to bring up something a little out of left field, but I will say. So I would say over the past year, we here in the United States have gotten to take a beautiful young cipher and turn him into all of our political dreams. Ladies and gentlemen, let us discuss Justin Trudeau in American culture and how he's filling the space that none of our, like, that Republicans thought Marco Rubio could, but just like, beautiful hair, amazing core strength, and like, you know, filling his cabinet with women because it's 2015.
It says things like, I'm a feminist. Why wouldn't you be?
Yes. It really feels like, with us, most of us knowing nothing about Canadian politics, a fun opportunity to just fall in love with this person who seems like kind of like Jeb Bartlett from The West Wing. Mm-hmm. Like, person from fictitious land who seems like a real liberal.
Canada bouncing back hard from Rob Ford. That's what this
says. <That's
true. laughs> Fair point. But I feel like Justin Trudeau sticks to Canada harder than someone like Rob Ford does.
Oh, for sure. And for good reason. I think that, you know, I mean, among the people who are going to be hard eye emoji over Justin Trudeau, they probably feel pretty predisposed to like Canadian politics in general or think highly of it. So I don't know. I mean, I would be curious about how like someone like my grandma who typically judges male politicians based on their looks. thanks, Grandma. you know, among maybe a couple other factors, like, but has no political interest in like what he's about, how she would react to a Justin Trudeau as opposed to like a self-proclaimed feminist in America.
Mm-hmm. Could you imagine an American equivalent running for president and winning?
I feel like Gavin Newsom is maybe like the closest.
I feel like this is how Barack Obama was positioned for the time.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
like, I think we've elevated our sort of requirements for this type of dreamboat. But yeah.
One thing I will say is Canada is a place largely devoid of political charisma. Only once in a generation do you get somebody that you get to be excited about. Here, we have a lot of political charisma, and it's one of the reasons that this year is so weird and hard. Because, like, Trump is charisma, but it's not political charisma. And Hillary is almost resisting it. If you think about the number of times she and Bill had been on, like, national interviews in 92 by this point in time, if you think about the number of, like, groundbreaking speeches that Obama had given by this point in time, and, like, Hillary is just like, yard signs, I will show up with more delegates, yard signs.
Yeah, and she's, well, and she would be the first to admit it, that, like, she is not a charisma candidate, which is really, I'm just like, wow, that is some bold, that's a bold statement to think that America can elect someone not on the basis of charisma.
It's
especially when she's up against, like, Mr. Persuasion Charisma.
Right.
And also, she has to make history. She has to show us how to do a thing that we've never done before, and, like, that was real easy with Obama. He was always, like, leaving breadcrumbs along a trail for, like, here is how you love and respect me. And she doesn't...
Well, she was punished earlier in her career for essentially being herself or, like, being a more independent feminist-type figure. I mean, all of her being punished about her, like, not baking cookies line or not using Clinton as a last name, all that stuff really early on that, you know, now maybe would play differently or play better. She's been trained, kind of, by us.
Sometimes I watch videos of Headband Hillary and just imagine what things will be like when she is loosed. When she actually wins and can just be fucking Hillary. Oliver, favorite representation of politics in fiction, past or present?
I think I came up with this question, but I can't remember what my answer was for it. I'm trying to think, get away from sort of recency bias and sort of think about like what I grew up with.
Do you want me to answer while you think?
Yes, please.
Okay, I'm going to give two answers.
All right.
They are... The J. Roach HBO movies, Recount and Game Change, which I think are amazing and stunning. The one about the Recount and then the one about Sarah Palin being picked,
yes.
Where you get Julianne Moore as Sarah Palin, which is amazing. And I feel like do one step better than W, where like W felt strange, like Game Change feels right. It feels on point. It like is giving you... access, and it's giving you a real actor sort of like interpreting this woman in a way that's human. And then my other one is the HMS Pinafore, which is Gilbert and Sullivan talking shit about the fact that the First Lord of the Admiralty who had been appointed had no experience in the Navy. And I just feel like it was a first splashy foray into like, let's in a goddamn musical comedy rake this asshole over the coals who I disapprove of and like kind of started mass culture of being able to turn a political wonk into a punchline. Mm. Margaret, do you have a favorite representation of politics?
Well, like you, I really love Bullsworth, but I want to talk about Idiocracy because
we're about to elect President Camacho.
Yeah, I mean, I just watched this for the first time this morning.
Like, oh, really?
I missed it when it came out. I just never caught up to it. And I finally was like, I have to watch this. And I noticed, too, that it's the 10-year anniversary of the movie.
Jesus.
Yes. And Ethan Coen, who was the co-writer with Mike Judge, had recently tweeted that he didn't know that Idiocracy was going to become a documentary.
Yeah.
And so it feels very eerie watching it now because it really does have scary parallels to Trump. I mean, Camacho is he's the president of this far future world that is, you know, filled with garbage and everyone's eating Carl's Jr. and it's just this like rack of branding and insanity. And he is a former wrestler and porn star. And you look at Trump, and Trump has made appearances on Wrestling Mania. It's like there is a corollary between the kind of outsized, absurd personalities where you don't know what this person can say that would actually curb his appeal. I watched that this morning, and I could not believe how prescient it was.
That movie has such a beautiful heart, and its notion that, like, Luke Wilson and Maya Rudolph together will be enough to get, like, that America remembering its responsibility to run itself will always take charge is kind of a beautiful testament to the power of democracy. Oliver, do you have a better answer now?
Yeah, I do. It's not necessarily my favorite, but the one thing that came to mind when I was thinking about older stuff, and maybe this was you were talking about Sigourney Weaver playing some, you know, avatar version of Hillary, but it was Dave.
Dave's so good. Dave is another one of the what if the president could date movies.
But it's, I mean, for people who forgot the premise of Dave, and it starred Kevin Kline, is he plays someone who is identical in appearance to the current president who's fallen into a coma. And just the sheer sort of, just start with that idea, like, he's basically, by random genetic cosmic coincidence, looks identical to the standing president, and therefore when the real president falls ill, they bring him in to basically play the president. What, like, an insane concept to begin with for a film.
Also a really interesting analysis of white masculinity. Like, that it really
the
is...
The self-perpetuating nature of power structure?
Yeah, just that every white straight guy kind of understands, I might have to do that.
Yeah, Idiocracy plays into that, too. I mean, I think now it reads much more of a critique of, like, white bro culture than
it
did then. Yes.
I need to
watch
that
again. Because there's not really much about women in that film at all.
Yeah.
I mean, besides Maya Rudolph, there's nothing.
Who is a prostitute.
Common thread in political movies. There's not really much about women in there.
Yes.
But Dave is another one of those. It is about sneaking in a person with morality into this game without morality. Yes. So it's very Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Right.
But Sigourney Weaver is such an interesting character because she's clearly like a Hillary like surrogate. And it really like gets into the idea that she has become distanced from this man and they have become just a political alliance, but you know, she really gets to like step into the shoes of making policy once Dave shows up.
Right. And it was very West Wing-ish before West Wing came out because you have that sort of this ideal of a very liberal president. You know, he brings in his accountant buddy who basically becomes Secretary of the Treasury for like a day and fixes the budget, which is amazing, you know, but
I just realized something horrible about West Wing as fantasy. One of the other fantasies of the West Wing is that Stockard Channing was just a recurring. During the period of time like that we had started out with Hillary Clinton, but what if the First Lady just showed up sometimes? And favorite representation of politics and media.
Well, I was going to say primary colors for lots and lots of reasons, but we've already discussed that and what makes it great. So I'm going to go with my other dystopian pick, which is The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
I mean, like,
that's
you
a
know,
good one.
This
really
is not a Margaret Atwood friendly room, Anne.
Let me
you
tell
can
you.
Leave now.
Let me tell you that dystopian political fictions, I think, are so important in, like, actually continuing to care, even when things feel so broken. It's just like, okay, well, you know, it can always get worse, and it can get worse in these specific ways, and you can draw lines between, you know, what a, you know, totalitarian state looks like in the future to maybe what it looked like as a sort of fucked up capitalist democracy, you know, years prior. I don't know. That's important for me personally.
That The Handmaid's Tale still runs on men in suits was always really interesting for me. That it wasn't giving you the jumpsuitiness that you get in dystopia so much. This really was like, this is Michigan or somewhere.
Yeah, it's like puritanical.
Yeah,
and that's why it's kind of brilliant, right? It's like, you know, tapping into the fact that repression often, like, explicitly says we need to go back to a time when.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Even if it wasn't a great time for everyone, it was maybe like
that we need to make America great again.
It's an authoritarian
time. This is what I'm saying. Yeah. This is what I'm getting at.
Okay, final thing. Oliver has a great question in here in our script. We have a script, you guys. It's a look behind the curtain. But just at this point in time, how do you write political fiction when something that if it happened on any political fiction, they would be like, fuck you. Like a game show host is now like in actively in competition for the presidency. I mean, Gina Davis being an independent who got the presidency on Commander-in-Chief, I had enough problem with that. But how do you outflank this reality?
I mean, if Trump gets elected, it's going to be really interesting to see the creative mind wrap their collective mind around this, because he is so exaggerated and absurd already. But I don't know what you would do. But that, I mean, I trust that somebody will know.
Well, I think maybe you just go even more dystopian. I think that's where I think that's the direction you go into.
Right. Well, feel good about the now. It could be worse.
Yes.
There's also the interesting dynamic of when you have something groundbreaking like that happen, it frequently takes a long time for fiction to catch up with it. Like during the entire time that Thatcher was prime minister of Great Britain, the prime minister in TVs and movies, always a dude, because prime ministers are dudes.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about, we've touched on Bulworth a little bit, and in some ways, Bulworth, that formula taps into Trump's formula, where his whole campaign gets, he wins again because he starts saying anything that he wants.
Yeah.
And that is happening. That used to be like the convention in so many political movies, is like, what happens when
the filter's off?
Yeah, the filter is off. Exactly. So now it's like we're living that reality.
I'm going to predict if Trump gets elected, our TV and movie politicians will get boring because or like conventional and noble, because we'll be terrified of reality and want to cling to the memory of men in suits who just got things done, kind of.
So they'll all be Trudeaus.
Yes, they will all be Trudeaus.
An army of Trudeaus. Mm. Beautiful hair.
Well, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back with our jams after this.
I'm Allegra Ringo, a dog owner.
And I'm Renee Colbert, a dog wanter. And we host a show called Can I Pet Your Dog? The podcast for unapologetic dog lovers.
You can find us every Tuesday on MaximumFun.org or on iTunes.
So, now what is this? Is it just a podcast where all we do is talk about dogs?
Sort of. We definitely have a segment called Dogs We Met This Week, where we tell you about, you know, dogs we met this week.
We also have a segment called Dog Heroes, as well as Cool Dog Tech and Stupid Dog Tech.
We also have some of your favorite celebrities. Lin-Manuel Miranda, who did Hamilton, has been a guest. We've got Leslie Margarita.
We've had Nicole Byer, Ann Wheaton, all the best dog-related celebrities. So check us out every Tuesday on MaximumFun.org or on iTunes.
Can I pet your dog?
Can I pet your dog?
With Renee and Allegra.
C-I-P-Y-D.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Oh, Anne Friedman.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And Anne, I don't know if you're familiar with the show, but every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Anne, do you currently have a jam?
I do have a jam. I'm in like a super, like, lots of deadlines, lots of work mode. And at the end of my day, I've been listening to this new song by the Julie Ruin, which is Kathleen Hanna's band, semi-solo effort. I believe she works with other people now, but for a while it was a solo effort. And the song is called I'm Done.
Let's listen.
Yeah, this is definitely like shutting off your laptop and then flinging it across the room.
I listen to like experimental jazz while I'm working, or like I listen to like classical music while I'm working. And then turn this on to signal that I'm done.
We gave Anna a fucked up mic today, so it's been moving around a lot, and she's worked well under very adverse circumstances.
It's just a tester.
Yeah, we like to throw this at somebody to see what their problem-solving skills are like. Margaret, what's your current jam?
My current jam is from Frankie Kosmos, and she's got this album called Next Thing. And Frankie Kosmos, if you don't know who she is Greta Klein. She is the daughter of Kevin Klein and Phoebe Cates, which I know might make you want to hate her just a little bit, and perhaps you will, but you can also see her as a little kid in Squid and the Whale. But in this song, it has this fantastically soft delivered diss. This is from Is It Possible Sleep Song. When you treat me shitty, you get mad.
Who would have thought we'd had a double Kevin Klein mentioned show today.
I know.
How unlikely is that?
Ending a song on what the fuck stretched out like that and then just with a tiny cake. I love it.
It's pretty great. Oliver, what's your jam?
I guess Big K, Kitronada, who is a Haitian Montrealian. I'm sure there's a better term than that. What do people in Montreal, what do they call themselves? Montrealians?
I don't know.
Okay. You are a resident Canadian expert here, Guy. I'm disappointed.
I should know.
But he basically went from making remixes of Janet Jackson songs 3 years ago on SoundCloud to having one of the most sort of anticipated new albums of 2016. The album's called 99.9%. It is really all over the place in a good way sonically, where there's a lot of dance and house music influences. There's like straight up new R&B beat, or what I would think of sort of maybe very kind of an LA sound electronic music, straight up hip hop stuff. The song I picked was with LA's Sid the Kid from the group The Internet, and this one is called You're the One, and this is Kitronada.
I could work to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That does go into our category of W Hotel elevator music.
Yeah. Sure.
$14.
But in a good
$14
way.
$14 cocktail.
In a good way.
It's not the worst. All right, you guys. Before I declare my jam, I have to say, just a couple of days ago was Memorial Day, and we all know what that means. That means that the official Pop Rocket Summer Jam season has begun.
Oh, my God.
We will put up a thread on Facebook, and you guys will tell me what you think the song of the summer is. And then on July 4th, we as a panel will hammer out what my official song of the summer should be. Last year, you guys did such amazing work. You guys were the first ones to tell me about Cheerleader. You were the first ones to tell me about Peanut Butter Jelly by Galantis. You were the ones who told me about I Don't Like It, I Love It by Flo Rida. And all of those were great. None of them were actually in my summer jam.
Cheerleader was not great, let's just say.
I know, but it was powerfully the song, like, it was had such strength to be Song of Summer.
Can I say something controversial? Yeah. I actually don't think you can pick the Song of Summer until summer is over.
Thank you.
What has happened in the summer and what That's did you what hear everywhere and what did you want to listen to when you were drinking outdoors?
Yeah. July 4th is too soon.
That's a beautiful methodology for Call Your Girlfriend or whatever your podcast is called.
Thank you.
But this is our podcast and we have to know what the Song of the Summer is during the summer. Like, yeah, Demi Lovato released Cool for the Summer real, real late, but we managed to catch it now, didn't we? I'm sorry if that was harsh.
Really...
I'm with you, Anne. No one else is, though.
I don't manage to catch things. You know, I just catch them.
Unfortunately, I should be, opening up the season with some sort of glorious summer jam, or at least that Justin Timberlake song. Unfortunately... Mm. Something happened this week that we must address. We found out that Beth Howland died. Beth Howland, to most Gen Xers, you probably remember from reruns of Alice, where she played one of the waitresses. She played the ditzy one. But she also was in the original cast of Company and originated the song Getting Married Today, which is one of the greatest triumphs of a performance. It really is. Many people have taken stabs at this song, and no one does it right except for Beth Howland. Let's hear it. Gifts and the flowers, thank you all, but it's back to the showers. But I'm not getting married today. So it is 3 minutes of panic attack just delivered in this frenetic patter, which is amazing. It really is at a time before we really talked about what panic attacks were, having this person illustrated in such a delightfully Sondheim way. But beyond that, Linda Holmes this week on NPR, also Linda Holmes hosts the Drag Mother podcast of this podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour, where she talks about going into an internet hole about this, discovering the D.A. Pennybaker documentary about the making of the cast album of Company, which is amazing. And Linda unearthed video from 2012 of Mr. Lin-Manuel Miranda in his house rapping. Wow. Not Getting Married Today. So I posted that on my personal Twitter. I will post it to the Pop Rocket Twitter. But Linda's piece is a beautiful exploration of going into an internet hole. But I would say, like, every like little like branching path off of that hole is worth its time, and y'all should enjoy it. Much love to the memory of Beth Howland. And also, the other point I wanted to make is every time you watch a shitty sitcom and you're like, who is this person on this shitty sitcom? Like, as a child, you never realized the possibility that they were an amazingly talented person who was just getting to finally cash in because Broadway don't pay the bills. So remember that, kids. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brown, with Margaret Wathler, Oliver Wang, and very special guest, Anne Friedman. Anne, where can people learn more about you?
Everything is at annefriedman.com or callyourgirlfriend.com.
I'm sorry I cast dispersions on your podcast. I'm sure that your methodologies for selecting songs of the summer are extremely respectable.
I respect you, which is why I kept my thoughts about Sondheim to myself.
Whoa, I know!
Whoa, fuck!
Don't burn the studio down!
It's hot in here, huh?
Can we just get a one-liner of why you don't care for Sondheim?
Well, it's going to open up. I had an ex who was obsessed with Sondheim.
Okay. Understandable.
Enough said. Yeah.
He's a broken man who makes beautiful, beautiful songs and lyrics.
You cannot say the same of my
own. Oh! We post our show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links to the episode in the episode description of this podcast. We will not be having any links to criticisms of Stephen Sondheim because I don't want to promote that kind of thought. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Nate! !!!! Michael Chase Rowe, Dean H. Second. Thank God you're here, Margaret. And CoolioBoy911 for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. And that's a good number of reviews. Thanks. If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topic, enjoy the conversation or our Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rocket. And be sure to tell us what you think the song of the summer should be. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the, let's be fair, tardy Christian Duenas and Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.